Okay, great. Well, good evening to you all. It's now Boxing Day here, but Merry Christmas to everybody in America. So it was beautiful hearing Regina talk beforehand. I've spent a lot of time in Tiruvannamalai, and it was really nice hearing her experiences. My teacher, one of my teachers, was Ramesh Balsaka, who was a student of Ramana Maharshi, and I'm really bad at pronouncing his name, so please forgive me, Nisargadatta Maharaj. So, Nisargadatta, Ron's laughing, so I've said it wrong. So I open it up to if anyone has any questions. I have some questions that people have written to me and asked me over Facebook and YouTube. But if not, I'm happy just to sit in silence with you all for a few minutes and see if anything comes up. See what words are coming. Yes, thank you, Wilson. There's his name written. So the last few months or 6 months, I've reflected a lot on death, and considering it's Jesus' birthday today, or apparently Jesus' birthday today, I thought I'd start off talking about death. One of my favorite quotes, or a quote that I really like, is life isn't the opposite to death. Death is the opposite to birth. Life has no opposite. I get a lot of people writing to me about death, about a few people I'm speaking with are currently dying at the moment. One guy I'm talking with called Kent has a tumor in his throat. And I talk with them about what it means to die, what it actually means to die. And I know I've said a few times that I have died, that Lisa has died. Or I've said, I know what it is to die. When I was awakening, or when I was flip-flopping a lot, I used to reflect on what it was to die. And I realized, or I began to see, that where the sadness lied about death was not actually the idea of dying, but it was the idea of losing things. Of losing my mum, losing people I knew, losing time, no longer having the idea of tomorrow, losing memories, things that I'd done in my life, people I'd met, people I'd known, particularly memories, experiences. But it was never actually a sadness about the idea of dying. The sadness lay, or the discomfort laid in ideas, in losing ideas of self, never in the actual death, idea of death. In fact, when I really looked at it, I wasn't scared of dying. I went to sleep every night and disappeared. I happily went to sleep every night and disappeared. I'd go into meditation and sort of disappear in meditation. But the fear came, the idea of all the things that I'd apparently lose, all the objects that I would lose. Particularly the idea of tomorrow. This was one of the most hardest ideas to let go of, the idea of tomorrow. And when I talk to people about dying, that's the hardest thing they find to see through, the idea of being alive tomorrow. And now what happens here, it feels like my happiness or who I am isn't dependent on there being a next moment. I have no idea what the next moment brings. And it's like my happiness or who I am isn't dependent on that next moment. And you get some teachers, I'm just reading glimpses here of saying that nobody ever dies, or there is no death, or there's nothing to die. And actually, to be honest, I don't really know what that statement means. Now, the sensation or the feeling that comes here is that it just doesn't matter, it's just not thought about. That just doesn't arise. There's just this present moment, so happy to be in this, doing this, being this. And what used to keep me out of this, or apparently keep me out of this, appear to keep me out of this, was all these ideas of what I feared to lose. All these ideas that I needed tomorrow, that I needed in the future to get this or get that, or for this to happen. Of losing memories, of losing identity, or losing people. When that all fell away, there was just this present moment left, and there's no longer any thought about dying. I just don't think about having to be alive in the next moment or not. It just doesn't come up anymore. There's no fear around thinking about death. It's just very immediate living. Yeah. Nobody dies. The Tibetan Book of the Dead says nobody dies. And I presume that it means by nobody dying is that there was nobody here in the first place. There's just only ever experience. It's only ever ideas, thoughts about self that's afraid of dying. It's ideas of having tomorrow. It's an idea of who you think you are. Yeah, no fears outside of story. And you get so many teachers, and I don't disagree with this at all, but teachers that say you've got to be in the moment. And that's not what happened here. It was that all that kept me out of this experience now fell away. All the ideas of having to be a certain way in the future, of having to appear a certain way to people, having to behave a certain way, fell away. It says, will you share your thoughts on the birth of Christ? Yeah, I'll go back to the birth of life. I'm just on a train at the moment. So my teacher, Ramesh, and also had another teacher called Roger, he used to say that the ego or the sense of self is made up of certain dynamics, and those dynamics, and I know in A Course of Miracles it talks a lot about guilt, but I actually don't know too much about The Course of Miracles, so I just have to tell you what my teachers taught me. And they'd say the sense of self was made up of guilt, blame, expectation, worry, anxiety, shame, and pride. And they'd say this is what the whole sense of self is made up of, these dynamics. And the guilt, I'll explain what I mean by guilt and blame, first of all. So guilt is living in the idea of I shouldn't do something, I shouldn't behave a certain way, I should have done this better, I'm a bad person for having done this wrong, I've not behaved in the correct way. I can never get enlightenment. I can never get it right. I'm never going to get to liberation. I'm never going to be happy. I'm always going to mess up. This is the dynamic of guilt. Then the opposite of guilt is blame. So they did something. They are a bad person for having done this to me. They're a bad person for doing that action, for not cleaning the house when I said they should clean the house, for speaking to me in a certain way, for looking at me a certain way. How dare they behave like this? I don't want them to behave like this. This continuous second of self that's claiming and thinking it can do life. Blame and guilt both live in the dynamic that there's somebody there that can claim, do, and be life. It's the second. It's cutting you from being in just this. It's giving an energetic and mental thoughts contraction of I need to do something about life. I need to make life better than it is at this moment in time. And this is what my teachers say that all suffering comes down to, this dynamic. The expectation is about tomorrow, or expectation. So say if you say Christmas Day, I need my family to behave in a certain way in order for me to be happy. I need my parents to behave a certain way. I need them to talk to me in a certain way. I need them to validate me in a certain way. And these dynamics are so complicated. They're set up from such an early age, they can become so incredibly complicated. Expectation. You need your partner to behave in a certain way. You need them to give you a certain amount of attention, take you out for a certain amount of dinners, or buy you a birthday present on your birthday, clean up the kitchen, not eat your food, whatever the expectation is. And then the opposite, although I'm not quite sure if these are really opposites, but the worry and the anxiety is then feeling the other way, of fearing of these expectations not coming true. So I'm not going to get my tax in time. I'm not going to have enough money to see me round to the rest of the year. I'm trying to think of anxieties and worries. Well, I'm sure you can imagine all the anxieties and worries. But all of them are living in the dynamic that you're a separate self that can do and control life, when really all there ever is life, is experience. It's the second, the self, the ego, which is the suffering, which is the imagination that you can do something, you can control and create life better than God has created. That you can do a better job than God. All there ever is life, is this moment. It's now almost bizarre to think of these expectations that I used to have of people, like that they have to behave or treat me in a certain way. And I'm not saying I leave myself in abusive situations. Now it seems that Lisa's a lot more active in doing and being what she wants. I think you guys talk about it as in... hearing, how do you say it, Laura? The hear God? No. how do they say it in the Course of Miracles?
To follow guidance, to follow the Holy Spirit.
To follow guidance, that's it. To follow guidance. So it's not that I say I follow guidance. It's not like I hear a voice in my head. It's just that it's known what to do. There's no longer any doubt around action. That's my phone. it's known in every situation. There's not much indecision, doubt. Sometimes there's contemplation about what to do, but it's just the energy comes up, the body knows, or even it can be in thoughts, but it's just known. There's no longer all that doubt of I'm going to do it wrong, or I need to be perceived in a certain way. There's just no longer the second. And so many people hear this this teaching, or the no self teaching, and they expect it to be, like, they almost expect it to be walking around in this bliss state of no self, almost like they've had a lobotomy, and that they're kind of in constant orgasm. But really what it is, this is just setting up another idea of what liberation is. It's the absence of suffering. And suffering is this seeking energy of trying to make life better than what it is. And it's so simple. And you know this. Everyone knows this. I was shocked when I stabilized in happiness, or whatever you want to call it. I was shocked that everybody knows this. They've experienced it their whole life, and it's so simple and so obvious. They know what, you know what it's like to be without a self. You remember it particularly in childhood, but also throughout your life when you're fully involved in something. And it's if I'm to talk about it in a positive, I often talk about it in the negative, the absence of suffering, the absence of blame, guilt. But if I'm to talk about it in the positive, it's a general glow. You go into a situation and it's not because of the situation. You're just happy. You're just open to whatever's happening. You've got no ideas about what could or couldn't happen. You're just open, happy. Rupert Spira calls it, he calls it beauty, happiness, and I think understanding. I might have said it wrong. But it's just being open and receptive to life, and a joy about you. Joy of I am this, I am alive, I am as ecstatic to be alive. It's only the Lisa and I should behave like this and shouldn't do this that creates that contracted energy of self. And when I talk like this, it sounds like I'm just talking about thoughts, or I'm just talking about belief systems, but it's also, and this is the most important bit, is the energetic contraction. Because actually, if you think about the thoughts and the belief systems in themselves, they don't hurt you at all. They're just words. But it's the energetic contraction of selfness, which is incredibly uncomfortable. The closeness to life. The closeness to... In order to stabilize in the state of happiness, is it important to step away from your normal chaotic life? No, but I'll tell you what happened here in Lisa's, in my story. Sometimes I get carried away in calling myself Lisa. I think it's a bit disturbing to hear. what happened in my story was I met Ramesh in 2006-2007, and I lived in London. I was a playwright and lived in London. I also worked with kids with emotional behavioural disorders and taught performing arts. And then I'd met Tony Parsons. I'd been practicing Buddhist, and I just got to the point where I didn't know what to do. I was exhausted, so I went and decided to stay with Ramesh in India. It was cheap living, and I also respected Ramesh, but also it was like I was exhausted. So I just went there out of exhaustion. Everyone had told me about Ramesh. And then when I was there, I met my final teacher, Roger. And Ramesh said to me, you must listen to everything Roger says, which is very intense because Roger was also my boyfriend. You must listen to what he says. He knows what he's talking about. Don't be fooled by your mind. Listen to him. Don't be fooled by all your contractions. And Ramesh kept going on in front of the satsang group, in front of other people when I was by myself. I must listen to Roger. So then I went and lived with Roger in Australia. That's where I am now. I think I met Roger again in India. I went back to see Roger in India, and then I went to live with him in Australia. But I never actually consciously thought I'm going to live with him. I just went to stay with him for a month in Australia. And he lived in the forest in the middle of nowhere, really, completely surrounded by the bush. And there was very little activity around his house. Now, I'd always been in London. I'd grown up just outside London. I'd always had a very busy and hectic life in London, in the city. I'd lived in the city for 10 years. And so I went to live with Roger. And what happened was I never had the urge to leave him. So I just carried on staying. I just kept on extending my ticket. There was never the thought, I want to go. And then what began to happen was I began to give everything up slowly over time. And this sounds terrifying to the mind. And it was never conscious, but I slowly, I couldn't work because of visas. So I began to let him support me. I stopped contacting and speaking to old friends. I gave up using the internet. I used emails occasionally, but I gave up Facebook. I gave up just using the internet. I stopped going out, really. I began to lose interest in food. Food was always my big hook. I even began to lose interest in films, in reading books, in listening to spiritual teachers. So, but it was never a choice. I never chose to lose interest in these things. It just slowly happened. It was like everything in which I'd held importance to was stripped away. And I don't think this has to happen for everyone. But what seemed to have to happen here was that all my seeking energy in the past of my happiness is in going out for a nice dinner, is in living in a city, is in becoming a successful playwright, is in communicating with my friends on the internet, is in being a self-sufficient woman, is in having my own money, in having my own house, my own properties. This all began to fall away. And I began to be left with nothing. I didn't have any expectation or ideas about the next day because I was just living at Roger's house. We were talking about happiness, but I had no idea of what I was doing the next day. At any time, I could potentially leave, but that just began to fall away. And then because also I began to lose the friendships that I had and stop using the internet, I began to just naturally do a lot of sitting. Just sitting, it's nice and warm here, sitting outside, sitting on the day bed, lying in bed. And slowly everything began to fall away. All my expectations, my blame. At first I tried to blame Roger when I first went and lived there for my unhappiness. I first tried to blame it all on him. He wasn't taking me out enough. He wasn't doing this. He was annoying. He was irritating. He was dirty. He didn't keep the house tidy enough. He didn't walk the dogs enough. But then that began to see through. You can blame someone a certain amount. And then I couldn't exactly blame the trees around me. That was the only other living thing. The trees, the plants, the dogs. I couldn't exactly blame them for my unhappiness. So everything got pointed back here. And I was just left with what is, just this moment. My expectations of tomorrow fell away, my blame, I couldn't hold the blame that the world had created my unhappiness, that others had created my unhappiness. I couldn't even blame myself anymore because for me not finding my own happiness, my own guilt. And so it's not that I believe that you have to leave your chaotic life behind at all, but all your attachment to your present life being a happiness, to your kids, to your money, to your situation being your happiness falls away. I have nothing, I have no idea now, I'm selling you nothing in a way, of anything being my happiness, my boyfriend, or I'm looking after two Shih Tzus at the moment. It's not that I don't greatly enjoy them, I greatly enjoy Laurent, I greatly enjoy the dogs, I'm staying in a beautiful friend's house at the moment. in the city. I really enjoy it, but none of it is seen as my happiness. None of it. So the attachment to your present life being your security, being your happiness, being who you are, needs to fall away. And it's just left with what you are, who you are, is happiness. It's perfect, brilliant stillness and radiance, just as you are. So nothing in your life is your happiness. And this is radical. It sounds easy when I say it, because I'm saying to you, your happiness isn't, say, your kids, your family, your mom and dad, being in relationship with your mom and dad, being in relationship with your kids. Not that they're not a great pleasure, you don't enjoy them, but they're no longer your identity of happiness. Yeah, so when I say happiness, I'm talking about what Regina was just talking about, the stillness, the space, the openness. So I just call it happiness. You glow. No expectations of anything making you happy, including tomorrow, including the activities of what you're doing tomorrow. And it's always here, your happiness. But while the attention is on seeking, while your attention is on material objects, on family, on even spiritual teachings, it will give the impression that there is a seeker, and that impression will be suffering. Who's saying no more Facebook? Is that Julie? God's will is your happiness. I don't really know what you mean by God's will. I know you guys are coming from a different teaching, and I do not think that any teaching that talks about happiness and who you are is wrong. It's just all different ways of looking at it. What I would say when it says God's will is your happiness is not acting as the self itself, not acting as the second, not acting through the interpretation of the ego. God's will is just action, just beingness. Ramesh used to call it God's will. Ramesh used to say that all of this is God's will, and that happiness is seeing that there is no one there ever doing anything. It's all God's will. Oh yeah, look, you've got my website. I don't think it's not complete yet, it's just up. It should be complete in the next month or so. I'm here now. It very much feels like now the difference, the massive difference, is this action. This action knows so certainly what to do. This action coming through the body. And you could call it God's will. And some people hear it through voices, Ramesh. He used to, even in front of people sometimes, it was like he was having conversations with God. He used to also do it with Ramana. It was like he would ask Ramana's opinion sometimes. But it's seeing that there is nobody here. All of this is God's will. You can't change, create, or make life. all that changing, trying to create, trying to make life is the suffering, is the separate self. And happiness is when that separate self is no longer seeking. No longer trying to make life better, no longer trying to create business deals with life, with others. If I treat this person this way, they'll treat me this way. This is all stepping out on just this. But it's not that thoughts don't still happen. Thoughts still happen here. It's just that energetic contraction no longer happens. You were supposed to listen to your boyfriend and do everything he said. That could be a bad idea in some circumstances, yes? Let's say, if I know God's will is happiness and I'm going to guilt or believe that I'm screwed up something, would you say that screwing up is God's will? Yes, so hang on, I'll just answer Lisa's first. So, yeah, there's two answers to that. Firstly, the situation I was in was I very much trusted. And I'd spent a lot of time with Ramesh Balsaka, who told me that I was to listen to my boyfriend. But firstly, because there's no longer a sense here that someone's doing something. So when I look back on it, at that time when I started listening to Roger, I believed that somebody was here doing something, or I was in and out of believing there was someone here doing something. So I believed I was making the choice to listen to my boyfriend. However, now when I look back on it, I had no choice in that. That was just what happened, and it couldn't have been any other way. Yeah, and it could be disastrous to listen to somebody who's a sociopath. But in another way, like, I mean, I'm not recommending or suggesting it at all, but in another way, I couldn't give over my will to God at that time. And so in a way, what happened to me was I firstly gave it over to Roger and then gave it over to God. Or I firstly gave it over to Ramesh, then to Roger, and then to God. And that's often what happens. You first of all give it up to your guru. You give your will to your guru. And that's not always the case for everyone. It's so different for everyone, this the apparent story of liberation is so different. You might have found that you've done this with A Course in Miracles. If you're a Course in Miracles student, you gave everything over to A Course in Miracles and listened to everything that said, or you gave it over to the teachers in A Course in Miracles. Mm-hmm. Does that answer, Lisa? I like your name, Lisa. So let's say if I know God's will is happiness and I'm into guilt or believe that I've screwed up something, would you say that screwing up is God's will? Yeah, everything is God's will, even the apparent separate self. That too is God's will, but the separate self believes it's a somebody doing something. So when you're in the dynamic of separate self, it feels like you are somebody doing something and that you're screwing up. Really, you'll see eventually that is God's will too. But at the time, it feels like you're doing something and that you're screwing up and that you've got it wrong. And that is the dynamic of the separate self. That is guilt, blame, identification. And that is eventually what will leave you. And it can't ever leave you until you give all your will to God or all your will is taken. Because as long as there's an idea that you can do something or that you're controlling this, there will always be guilt and blame. Guilt and blame can only exist. And guilt and blame are the primary causes of doership. And they can only exist with the idea that I am a separate self doing something. And as long as there's any identification that you can do something, there will still be the ability for guilt and blame. But it's all very impersonal. When you're in the separate self, it will look like everyone's doing, and it will look like I'm now talking from prescription. But when you see that life is just happening impersonally, you'll see that nobody's ever doing anything, and that the way that I'm talking is actually description. But when you're looking through the eyes of a separate self, it will always sound like prescription, and it will always sound And you always see doership, so you'll see doership in me. And this is why I often say that I don't see myself as a teacher and I can't liberate anyone because I can't see anyone there doing it. But from the other side, when you're in doership, and most people are always flip-flopping in and out of suffering, in and out of doership and non-doership. What was I saying? When you're in that dynamic, you'll experience me as a doer. I think that's what I was saying. I forgot. But I again now sucked into these comments and questions, so let me read. I've experienced a dominant personality who kept insisting I give... I've experienced a dominant personality who kept insisting I give over my will to him, but something in me knew not to do it, but he called me stubborn. I believe I made the right choice not to surrender to that. Yeah. And the body knows, the body and the actions, and it won't happen. Like the experience, like when you get into the stream of liberations, Buddhists call it stream entrance. Once you're in the stream, you'll only ever have the experiences that are needed for that personality type. So once you've entered the stream of liberation, there's no way out. And so it will always go the right way. So you don't have to still, you can give up that idea that you could get it wrong. Like, you're going the right way. You're always going the right way. And the reason I like that teaching of stream entrance is because most people are constantly doubting and believing that they're doing something wrong. And what it's doing by saying the stream entrance is it's trying to unpick those ideas that you can mess this up, you can get it wrong. Can you hear my dog snoring? Can you hear that, Rob? they're like a foot long and they can create the biggest snore. And this is something Ramana Maharshi used to say, that all these teachings, like at the end of the day, you chuck all these teachings out because it's one thorn removes another thorn. So you use one concept to remove another concept and then you chuck them all out. Like, I now don't live in the idea of no doership or living in God's will or any of that. I'm just experiencing, I'm just being. I only use this to try and communicate it. So, what was I saying that in relation to? I was saying that in relation to somebody's question. Also, something else that's happened to here is that my mind doesn't function as well as it used to. I'm so forgetful. So yeah, it's just... Can I have some more, please, from Wilson? So if someone interrupts me or distracts me when I'm talking, I can very rarely remember what I'm talking about. Sorry, what is this? Marines are steeped in illusion, it seems. My projection. Oh, I don't know. See if there's any other questions I've missed up here. And if I was halfway through just answering your question and I've forgotten it, you can remind me. Sylvia. No, I'm in Perth, Australia. It's 10 o'clock in the morning here. I'm doing it through Skype because Macs aren't so great with PowerTalk. So, which is a shame because I love it. I think PowerTalk's a great way to communicate this. Yes, and I can see Laurent too. He's in a little box just by PowerTalk. Is pain in memory? So the way I teach this, and remembering that we're all coming at this from different languages, so trying to find the middle ground for yourself, is that pain and pleasure are a natural experience, and that's what the whole of life is a series of different pains and pleasures. And then on top of this, you get the separate self. And the way the separate self is born, so in the beginning, there's just the baby. And the baby's just experiencing pains and pleasures. When it's cold, the baby cries. When it's getting fed milk, it's very happy. And it's just being. It's just completely being in the sense of wonder and then the experience of pain and pleasure. And pain and pleasure are always the same. They can come through different forms. Like you can have different boyfriends, different experiences, travel the world, but pain and pleasure are always the same experience. They always feel the same. Then the separate self gets born, and the separate self says, I need to get pleasure and I need to avoid pain. And this is the very beginning of the separate self, and it normally happens at 1 or 2 years old, when the baby begins to perceive there is a body here, and the baby begins to perceive I am a body, whereas before it was just beingness, and then it perceives I am the body, and then it thinks I've got to get pleasure and avoid pain. And then it gets incredibly complicated through years and years of building on this. At first it's very simple. Pleasure is the boob, and pain is not getting the boob, or not getting the milk, or not being warm. And then pain becomes your brother or sister stealing your toy, stealing the attention, and then you try to avoid that. You try to avoid your brother or sister getting the attention. Maybe you hit them or lock them in the cupboard, and then you see your brother or sister as competition. And pleasure comes when you get the attention. And so maybe you get the attention as the naughty boy. Maybe you're taught you're a naughty boy, but you're getting pleasure from getting that attention. So now then you create a whole, or then there's a whole dynamic of the naughty child created. They get pleasure when they're naughty, when they misbehave. Or maybe they get attention when they cry a lot, when they are sulking. And so therefore that dynamic's created more and more and more. And the self gets so complicated, so complicated, of the different ways in which to seek pleasure and avoid pain. And I say that the base seeking pleasure is seeking for love, and the base trying to avoid pain is the avoidance of fear. These are the two dynamics which are the main drive of the separate self, or the ego, is seeking for love and avoiding fear. And so if you look at your whole life, you'll see that, not necessarily you guys, you maybe aren't so caught in it, but before, when you're more caught in the story, the majority of the time you're trying to seek love, validation, approval from others, and you're trying to avoid fear, avoid uncertainty, avoid vulnerability. Now, what was your original question, Wilson? Is pain in memory? Okay, so pain is not in memory. Pain is the experience. If somebody burns me in this moment, or if I touch the fire, that is a physical experience in this. Pleasure, eating a piece of chocolate is an experience in this. What's in the memory, what's in the suffering, is the idea that you need to get pleasure and avoid fear. That's what's in the memory. And that's the whole setup of the separate self, or the ego, trying to get pleasure and avoid pain. But the experience, my life now is just an experience, lots of experiences of pleasure and pains and in-betweens. That's what experience is. And now there's almost a sense of all pains and pleasures are the same. That's how they're also enjoyable, and also they're also different in a way. They're all, like, it's just a series of pleasures and pain. And I'm not attached to trying to get them or not get them. Okay, so let's read a bit more. Pain and pleasure the same until the separation, until we have this idea. What is the difference between the committed relationship and all relationships? It seems this love cannot be different with any. So is it just a decision to have sex with only one? In Tantra, and this is all theories, I don't really know. So this is all, just theories about the love relationship. In Tantra, they say that the physical act of two people making love, or two people coming together, is the greatest expression of oneness in the manifest form. So that love relationship is the greatest expression of oneness in the physical form, in the form. Because in form, it's always two. In form, it's always duality. And so this coming together of another is, that expression of oneness, which is beautiful. But it's a mystery, really, as to why or how that happens. But it's a beautiful act. I don't see it as a decision, staying with one person or being with one person. It is what it is. The feeling comes up to stay, or it's written for you to stay with that one person or not stay with that one person. What tends to happen here is that there's a tendency to stay with one person, just to be intimate with one person. But I don't think that that's the set way. Like it's different for everyone, and there's a lot of staying with the same person can be based on, when I say neurosis, I mean the separate self, can be based on the fear of being alone. We spend a lot of time trying to avoid our inherent aloneness, because we are all always alone, even though oneness is always this just us. And so we search for comfort in another. And when the relationship's based on all these ideas of wanting love or wanting comfort or wanting security from another, then the relationship will always be out of harmony. There will always be conflict in that relationship because you're seeking something from the other. And that's not what I'm talking about in Tantra. That's not an expression of oneness. That's an expression of suffering, trying to get something from another. And this was a great lesson with Roger, my teacher, because when you live with somebody who sees himself as no thing, as no longer has attachments to anything in life, if you still have an ego when you're living with somebody that is not trying to make you their happiness, for the ego, that can be hell. That can be... It's so disturbing to the separate self that's always based on trying to get happiness, trying to get something from another, trying to make the other give them something. And when you're living with someone that's not playing into those games, it's not playing into that dynamic of, I need you to make me happy, I need you to give me comfort, I need you to give me sex, I need you to give me validation. When that's not being played into, where can the ego go? The ego can either leave the person that's liberated, run away and hide, and say that they're, I don't know whatever you say, measurably with Roger, I'd say that he was, I'd call it cold or something, which isn't the case at all, but it's the ego defending it. Or it destroys the ego. In this case here, it destroyed it. Because you can't stay alive in that light. You can't stay alive in somebody reflecting nothing back to you. I couldn't get him to play any games with me. I couldn't get him to validate me, to believe in my suffering, to believe that he was the cause of my suffering, that he had done something wrong, that he had to behave a certain way. It completely diffused me. It was like putting a pinhole in a balloon. You know how the balloon just goes. It took quite a few years. Lived with him quite a few years, because there was nowhere for the ego to go. I couldn't get him to play into all my egoic and neurotic ideas of him being a separate self. And in the end, everything began to fall away. Now let me have a look at this. My husband sees something as I no longer care as much. And it can come across to the ego as not caring, because the ego is always trying to entice the other into its egoic games. So entice the other to make them feel better. when you're not seeing them as some, like, when you're no longer thinking that you can make them better, you can make them feel better, then you're not going to play in that game anymore. They are happiness. You are happiness. How can you ever make someone feel better? How can you ever make someone happy? So it can come across to the ego as not caring, as cold, because the ego is always based on patting everybody, like stroking everyone's back, telling everyone how great they are, or actually doing the opposite, telling them what an ass they are. But it's like always playing in that game of validating them as a somebody, as a separate self that's doing and being life. And so it can come across as not caring, but that only comes across as not caring to an ego. And now I have so little perceptions about people. They're just as they are. It's just experience. They just are as they are. Okay, so my husband sees me. No place to hide. Yeah, there's no place to hide. In front of the light of this, the light of nothing. Making no excuses for your unhappiness anymore. You are happiness. There's nothing that's making you unhappy. Just the perception of self. Just that energetic contraction of I'm a separate entity that needs to make and create life. To go alone and leave this world and enter. Everyone needs the hand that's tender. How cute. But how about twins? Ego's interpretation versus Holy Spirit's interpretation. How about twins? I'm not sure what you mean by the question. How about twins? We are all alone, even if you're a twin or not a twin. Wow, I can't believe I've talked an hour. Oh my goodness. Is there anything that I was slightly unclear about? Maybe towards the end I wasn't explaining the whole relationship, being in relationship with another in as much detail. If there's any last questions about the relationship or the intimate relationship, I've got 2 minutes to give it a go. Love to you all. Thank you everybody for coming. And I'm sorry if I missed questions. It goes quite quickly, all the words, all the writings and questions. But I just looked every so often and some shone out. Drumming. Is that the wrong typing that you're hearing? I would love to talk to you all again. I think that Power Talk is fantastic. They just need to get a little bit better with Max. This is a great way to do it. Talk live. Thank you. There is a way to make it work in Mac. Oh, is it Betsy? If you could let me know after, that'd be fantastic. Yeah, thank you, Jill, for asking me. VMware Fusion. Thank you, Betsy. Betsy. Is that how you say it, Lamar? Betsy?
I don't know.
Yeah, thank you, Lamar. It's like 2 or 3 in the morning in Paris. Laurent is back here on Tuesdays at 12 noon, 6 p.m. Paris time. There's the drummer again. So yeah, me and Laurent will be in Interior Vietnamalai for 5 or 6 weeks. So if anyone wants to come talk to me, to Laurent, about happiness, both of us, I'm just offering this for Laurent. He's never said he would do it, but I'm sure we're both happy to do that. I will be there. Lisa. Oh, fantastic. Interior.
I know Stephanie will be here from Canada as well. That'll be great. Awesome.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. And I've been going to Tiri for quite a few years in January and February, so I know lots of people as well, so it'd be really nice, and people I've met over Facebook. And if anyone wants help, if they are going to Tiri with cheap accommodation, because it's not so easy to find contacts for accommodation in Tiri, then please let me know and I can send you through some contacts. When are you going? I'm going from the 18th of January to the 6th of March, but possibly longer. And the run's going the 23rd of January to, I think it's a bit open-ended.
Yeah.
When are you going? Yeah. So fantastic. So good night, everyone. And I'll pass the microphone back to Dov. Thank you all very much. It's been a really beautiful morning for me and evening for you guys. Good night. Namaste.
Okay, thank you so much, Lisa Cairns, and thank you so much, Laurent Alilevi. Wow, truly grateful. And yes, we do live in a lot of grace, for sure. Thanking everyone for joining us here this evening, and I hope to do it again in the near future. And if you are listening, Lisa, I know you were here a couple of nights ago, and of course you were on the mic very easily and clearly. Probably just a little bit more prompting on how to pick up the mic. Two people can't be on at the same time, so those things do happen, but that happens with a little practice. It happens easily, so I know it does work on Macs these days. I want to thank Betsy for mentioning that she has also a way. She basically has a Mac, and she made it work so that she can use software that makes it compatible with PCs. But a Mac by itself can do it. Lisa Natoli's on a Mac, and she comes here on a regular basis and does it. Thank you so much, everyone, for being here. I also see, is it true that, yes, Suzanne from Munich is here, and it's 3 o'clock in the morning where Suzanne is. Thank you so much, all who have joined to be with us. And I'm just going to be turning this mic over to you, Ron Clark, NTI Study Group, on every Sunday night and every Tuesday night. Thanking all for being here. I will put this recording on Open Minds and on Lisa Cairns' page as soon as possible. It could be as shortly as the next 5 or 10 minutes. Thank you all. Wonderful, wonderful evening. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Merci, merci, merci.
Oh, hello. This is Ron, and it's time for the NTI study group. I just want to say